couple weeks ago, a week and a half ago, Dr. Steinberg, you know, emailed me to say that, you know, 8 years is an accomplishment. Seven in Judaism, you know, is the number of completeness. Seven represents a unit, or in the words of the Maharal, seven is the world of nature, and eight is beyond nature. Eight is already going beyond the normal, and I really want to thank. It's hard to believe that this is our eighth year doing it. We began, you know, 7 years ago in Tremblant, in Canada, in Quebec, and now we are back again for the first time in Canada, but the six intervening years in the States. And it's really, I can tell you, this is one of the highlights for me, anyway. It's a wonderful weekend. We've always enjoyed the camaraderie, the friendship, the great learning, the gashmiut, the ruchniut, the beautiful davening we have, and we're looking forward to another wonderful weekend. I really want to thank everybody over the years who made it possible, and Dr. Steinberg, along with Dr. Laser and the Metzes. We and, you know, Ilan and Gila, we are the only, you know, three families who've been to all eight. So we invite you to come next year to seven and eight, but and that's why we're making it in Ottawa, to make it easier for them to come. So it's really a pleasure, and of course I want to thank all the people behind the scenes who make it possible, Ilana, Karen Giblon in the office, and the Dr. Laser. And with that, really, I'll introduce Laser. We go back, you know, many, many years, and it's really been a pleasure. He takes care of all the medical side and the planning and the programming, and it's a pleasure to work with you all these years, and want to thank you once again, and Lakasha.
Good evening, everyone, and as Jay pointed out, welcome again to our annual conference. We're really excited again to put this program together for you. We have a lot of enjoyment through the year planning it, and we're actually planning already next year, so stay tuned about that. But Jay pointed out, I think, a lot of the faces that we've seen before, but I'm happy that there are some new faces, and we hope to get to know you over the Shabbos that we'll be spending together. It's really been a wonderful, in terms of the planning, and as Jay thanks myself and the others there, I certainly have to give the same sort of hakaras hatov to Jay and Ilana for spearheading this kind of a program, and I'm just humbled to be part of this entire entourage that we have with us, and over the Shabbos, I hope you get to meet and continue to explore and speak to the individuals that are here with us, because it's really an amazing opportunity when you stop and realize, you know, where we are and what we are doing. We're going to try and, as you know, I sort of get the lovely job of doing the housekeeping and, trying to keep the bus going and things like that. It's a wonderful job. Having said that, we'll try our best to do that. Tonight we have a slight incentive for those of you that want to participate in a bit of a Canadian experience. There is a sound and light show that Jay alluded to. It starts at 10 o'clock at Parliament Hill, which is about a 5 to 10 minute walk from here. We're scheduled to finish at 9:15. I know we won't, so that's like just already to let you know. But the plan for this evening is, and at least this is how it was concocted, that this is sort of an opener. You've traveled, you've had a little bit to eat, it's late in the evening, so sit back and, enjoy this evening. I'm not discouraging questions, but I am going to try to point out that, you know, the speaker is in time, and we're going to try to be sort of, you know, on time. There's much more housekeeping, as you know. I've always participated in that, and I'll do that with you tomorrow. I do want to share a brief idea, if I may, at the expense of the time, but nonetheless, I think if I may, to sort of put, for myself, the sort of mindset of how I think many of us approach a weekend like this. The question that comes up in this parsha that we're going to be reading in Parshas Pinchas is there is the famous incident of what is referred to as the Benos Tzalachat. The daughters of Tzalachot ask a very reasonable question, and the question, of course, is how will they inherit, and that is not for discussion for now, but rather the idea is, as many of you know, that they, having no sons in their children, The question would be, how would they be able to inherit any part of Eretz Yisrael? So they came to Moshe and they said, "What is the halacha?" Moshe Rabbeinu says, "You indeed have a question that I don't have an answer to." And the Torah tells us that Moshe did the right thing. He asked the question. He said, "Vayakrei Moshe es mishpatan." The term that is used is that it is for mishpat. Mishpat generally is the laws, the judges, things of that. The things that are generally speaking nature of sichli. They are the answer, the questions that have a reasoned type of answer to them. It is interesting that at the end of the parsha, when Hashem finally says, "Kein benos lovcho dovros," in other words, yes, they are indeed correct, and this is an idea that we have to make a modification, so to speak, and that's a separate discussion into how the Torah is going to operate. The Torah uses the term as follows: the Ha'isali bnei Yisrael uchkas mishpat. Suddenly, we change the language, and the Torah goes out of its way, and it says luchkas mishpat. Now, what is a chok? So, as we know, the quintessential chok is, of course, the paraduma, which is usually what is referred to. The idea of this is a law. This is a doctrine from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We don't understand it. Even Shlomo HaMelech doesn't understand it. That is the way the halacha runs. And that is how it's done. Mishpat, on the other hand, is what we understand. We put our logic, we put our intellect, we understand it, and we can be able to make something of it. Moshe was asked this question. He thought this is a question of mishpat, and the Torah seems to say at the end that it's that the idea is going to be, and the words are the chukas mishpat. So I saw a very beautiful idea from Rav Moshe Feinstein in his Drash Moshe and Parshas Chukas, which I suspect could perhaps answer the question about this terminology here. In Parshas Chukas, he describes the chok of the paraduma, and he basically explains that this is a chok. Question, of course, is, in next week's Parsha, we also see that the word chok is used when it comes to the concept of toveling kelim. Rav Moshe says, whilst the paraduma has the idea that it is extremely esoteric and it does not have any logic to it, Rav Moshe understands that toveling kelim is something that has a logical approach to it, and yet the Torah uses the word chok. And in both places, it uses chok and Torah together. Says Rav Moshe there, he suggests that is the whole idea. There is no such thing as an independent and isolated chok, and there's no such thing as an independent, isolated mishpat. If we understand that what is a chok as being that it comes from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, we have to also understand this idea that mishpat is also something that comes from a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And the example that he uses, and it's an example that Rav Soloveitchik uses as well, is when we look at the logic of saying we don't murder, we don't kill. So in other words, beautiful, it's a wonderful society, we don't kill. We don't need, for example, God to tell us that we shouldn't kill. And that would be the quintessential, the mishpat, the law of the land. But look what happens when we start to use our own intellect in understanding this, and we don't apply the understanding that this is min hashamayim, that this is from, in other words, it's beyond our judgment. In this country, we are witness to this idea of physician-assisted suicide. We are witness to the idea of euthanasia, which is essentially a form which is being branded in this country here as physician-assisted suicide, which has already passed the law. And the law basically says, of course we don't murder. Of course we would never think of doing murder. But there are times that we think that it's not such, we won't call it murder. That is perhaps what the Torah tells us. Every chok and every mishpat are intertwined together. The chok and the mishpat means that the chok that is, of course, it comes from God. But the mishpat that seemingly we can try to figure out for ourselves, the message is for us to understand that our intellect only goes so far. And that we have to understand that this is what it is. And perhaps this is how I look at this weekend, and I will share with you a confession that the truth is I absolutely never liked the talk, the title, the International Conference on Jewish Medical Ethics. I always thought it had some aspect that left me with, what does that mean, medical ethics? The world has medical ethics, the world has ethics as well, but of course every 20 years their ethics change and they move on to different poles. I have no difficulty, and nobody in this room has difficulty, understanding and reading a tshuva from Rav Moshe, where Rav Moshe says that cardiac transplant is double murder. The halacha never changed. The Torah never changed. What changed? The science changed. a kidney transplant that was perhaps usher according to Poskim in the years gone by, and now according to some is at least a mitzvah, and perhaps even maybe going to get into issues of obligation, and I'll leave our speakers to deal with that. Nothing has changed in terms of the moral, the principles of the Torah. What has changed is the science has changed. And for that reason, that is the understanding of how we look at such a weekend. So we look forward to a wonderful opportunity to share this with you and learn continue to learn from our wonderful speakers that we have. And on that note, it gives me a tremendous pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Rabbi Avram Dr. Steinberg. Rabbi Steinberg, as Jay pointed out, has been with us since our inception. I do recall always introducing and saying third year Chazaka, fourth year Chazaka, maybe second year Chazaka. I think we're at the point now where we're comfortable to say we don't get started until we look at the calendar and the schedule. But for all of us that have enjoyed really being together with Rabbi Steinberg and his wife, Lynn, they add such a royal majesty to our conference that it's just really a pleasure. I encourage you to read through the bios. I don't want to read bios to you. First of all, I will be accused of performing eulogies, and I certainly don't want to get into that. But needless to say, for any of you that that may not have it been, Rabbi Steinberg right now has a new job, and he is the director of the Yad Harav Herzog and head of the editorial board of the Talmudic Encyclopedia. So while he still continues to, I think, dabble in medicine, he is still he's very involved now in a new frontier, which is this, which is the Talmudic Encyclopedia, and he's the actual editor in chief of the Talmudic Micropedia. If you don't know about this, it's an amazing project, and I encourage you to approach him and to learn a little bit about this. For many of us in the room, he is the author of the Encyclopedia of Jewish Medical Ethics, which is our go-to encyclopedia, and it really is a great pleasure to introduce Rabbi Steinberg.
Thank you very much, and potchim b'chvod achsaniya tchila, since I am the first of the speakers in this conference, it really gives me great pleasure to acknowledge the major work that Rabbi Kelman and wife and Dr. Friedman and wife are putting into these conferences, and indeed we are at the eighth conference, which is amazing to keep paced and to do it annually, regularly, without skipping a year for so long, and finding out new frontiers of discussion, new lecturers, and really it is a marvelous work, and I wish success to continue and next year and the year thereafter and go on with this. I think it's a wonderful thing to do. Unfortunately, we are starting this conference with terrorism, but that's life. We are now really worldwide encroached with these problems of massive terrorism. In a way, the Middle Ages were terrorism of Christianity, the Crusaders, the Inquisition. Now we have new terrorism coming from the Islam. And unfortunately, so many lives are being sacrificed for such a tremendous issue that we are witnessing in the world. But when it happens, we need to know what to do from both sides of the coin. On the one hand, to treat the victims, and sometimes there are many of them, and we, unfortunately, in Jerusalem, have experienced over the year many such incidents, and in the hospital that I work at, in Shaarei Tzedek, most of these incidents came to our doors, and we needed to decide on how to triage the treatment of the victims. And the other side of the coin, how do you deal with the terrorists or terrorists who are injured, who survived the attack? Do you treat them? Do you prioritize them? What do you do? So these are difficult questions, and I'm not sure that what I'm going to tell you is really accepted by everyone. I'll tell you my ideas, and okay. So we have the two sides of the coin. On the one hand, how do you deal with issues concerning the victims, the disastrous situation, and on the other hand, how do you treat the pursuer or the terrorist in this aspect? So disasters in nature are numerous. It's not only terrorism, obviously. There may be a tsunami, there may be a hurricane, there may be earthquakes, wars, and so on. The end result is that we get many casualties, and we can't treat all of them at once. What do we do in such a circumstance? So, okay, so what is triage in essence? Triage comes from the French word that means to select or to choose. Napoleon's surgeons invented this idea and this term, and we use it to this day. And indeed, what we need to determine is what happens if we have two or more conditions and we can't provide treatment to all of them. How do we balance between the needs and the supplies? So looking at it from an ethical point of view, we can divide the responsibilities on how to treat such disasters to individuals' obligations, societal obligation, and the principles of triage decisions. From an individual point of view, as opposed to the Christian theology where they talk about a good Samaritan, which is optional, if you see a victim, if you see someone that you can help, and you do help, you're a nice guy. If you don't help, it's also okay. You're not obligated to do anything about it. And by the way, by law in most countries, there is no positive law to help others. Israel is the only country that enacted in by law the biblical phrase of "you shall not stand idle while your fellow's blood is shed," "lo ta'amod al dam re'echa," and we have in Israel a legislation called "lo ta'amod al dam re'echa," taken directly from Tanakh, from Torah. And it really obligates to treat. So that is a major difference between secular and Christian ethics versus our ethics, which is not optional, but actually is something that we ought to be doing as a mandate. So Rambam writes the following, and we should really remember it also when we come to deal with the terrorist activities. Whoever can save someone and did not save has transgressed lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. In other words, it's not optional, it's a transgression of a law. And the examples taken from the Gemara Sanhedrin are if someone sees someone drowning in the ocean, or bandits come and want to kill him or to injure him, or a beast comes on him, and he can save them, or he can hire someone to save, and he didn't do so, then he transgressed lo ta'amod al dam re'echa. Now, just as a side issue, the examples here are such that... Okay. The examples set here are such that there is not a major danger to the rescuer, but one should take into account that there is no zero danger. Even if I know how to swim and I see someone drowning, I'm obligated to take him out of the ocean, I am taking some risk. That has a lot of ramifications from halachic point of view, for instance, on kidney donation or bone marrow donation. How much risk am I allowed to take myself in order to rescue someone else? Is it only when it's zero risk to me, or even if there is some risk to me, I am obligated, and what seems to be from the examples of the Gemara and the Rambam, one is even obligated to take some risk, and the sum is debatable what level of risk you have to take, but that is something that we should bear in mind. So the questions that come up are, do we have to do it on a voluntary basis, or should we be compensated? Do I have to go out and treat and save everyone that I see on the street, or should I be paid for it? If I hired someone to do it, should I be reimbursed for the expenses that I put into the saving procedure? How professional do I have to be in order to save life? And what are the special obligations of a healthcare provider, which by halachic criteria has to take greater risks in order to save someone else than someone who is not a healthcare provider? So that if a regular person sees someone in a car accident on the street, he may not have to take the same risks as a physician or a medic who knows what to do about it has to take risks. A physician has to treat an infected patient, whereas a non-physician may not need to take this extra danger to himself. So these are some of the rules regarding to this. Okay. If we go to societal obligations containing disastrous situations, the issue comes up concerning allocation of scarce resources. How much of the resources that are scarce in every society do we have to put aside for a future event of a disastrous situation? At the moment, there's nothing happening, but still we have to invest in order to be prepared for the event that it happens, because if we are not prepared, when it happens, it will be too late to prepare. So we have to spend money on something which may never be spent on, yet we have not enough of resources to do all this extra money that we need for that purpose. So how much does a society have to spend in order to save societal members? So we have this rule that one is, that's a Mishnah in Gittin, that we don't have to spend too much on redeeming captures, Jewish captures, Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam. And what is the Tikkun HaOlam? The Gemara gives two examples, two understandings of what the Tikkun HaOlam is. One of them is relevant to our discussion, and that is that the public does not have to put itself out totally so that it will be poor and not have resources for other matters that the public is in need of. So that if, for instance, someone is captured and the ransom is huge, and if the public would pay all this ransom to save the one Jew that was captured, public will not have enough funds to do other things. So says the Gemara, you don't have to spend all this money, you have to spend it to a reasonable degree, which is debatable what is reasonable in each circumstance, but the idea is that we need publicly to have funds to save lives, but it is limited for public other needs that the public might have. Another example is that if there is a source of water and this source of water comes from the tap and there is a city next to this source of water, and there's another city in the bottom of this hill, obviously the one closer to the source of the water can take the water. But if it takes all the water, nothing will be left to the people that are in the bottom. So according to one idea, the first ones are allowed to take the water for their livelihood in order to survive. According to another idea, they are also allowed to take enough water to take care of their clothing, to wash their clothing, even though the people down the hill won't have enough water even to drink. So there are situations where there are conflicts of scarce resources, who takes priority in these circumstances. So now we come to the question, what do we do in a triage decision? Which means that there is either shortage in time to do two or more mitzvot at the same time, or there is shortage in the resource to do it. The difference is that if we talk about time, we are doing it every day. We put on talis and we put on tefillin. We can't do it at once. So what do we do first? We have to triage the mitzvah. We have to decide, do we put on first the talis or first the tefillin? But at the end, we'll put on both of them. So we'll fulfill the two mitzvot, but in a certain order. So there are rules, how do you do it? So as we men all know, we first put on the talis, and then we put on tefillin. Why? Because tadir v'sheino tadir, tadir kodem. Whatever is done more frequently takes priority over a mitzvah that is not done so frequently. And since a talis we put on every day, and tefillin we don't put on Shabbos, so talis is more frequently used than tefillin, therefore in the morning, you'll remember tomorrow morning, to put on first the talis, and then the tefillin. So we triage the mitzvah, but we fulfill both of them. Even within that, we have to put on both tefillin shel rosh and tefillin shel yad, but we can't do it at once. So which comes first? Do we put on first the tefillin shel yad or first the tefillin shel rosh? And here again, there are halachic considerations. What order do we do it? So we triage it, but we fulfill both of them. But what about a situation where I don't have enough money to buy both a talis and tefillin? And if I have enough money to buy only one of the two, which of the two will I buy? And that will be on the expense of the other one, which I won't be able to buy. So the other will not be fulfilled at all. And here the rule is that if we have enough money only for one of them, we buy tefillin and not talit, because tefillin are holier. And kol ha-mekudash mechavero kodem lechavero. So it's a different rule. But the rule is different because here we're not talking about the order that we have to fulfill the mitzvah, but the very existence of fulfilling the mitzvah. So these issues of triaging mitzvot comes up on hundreds of examples in halacha, and we know many rules on how to do it. But what about life-saving triage? So we have the famous source in the Mishnah of Harayot, Ha'ish kodem le'isha la'achyot u'la'shiva v'da, Kohen kodem le'levi, Levi l'Israel, Israel le'mamzer, which is a whole hierarchy of who we save first if we have time or resource to save only one of the few, of the people. So why is it so? I don't have time enough to go into each of the examples, but practically speaking, we do not follow today this rule of the Mishnah, although it's a Mishnah and it's brought in Rambam, and yet we're not following it. Why is, again, a big debate. Interestingly, the Rambam brings all the examples of the Mishnah except for Ha'ish Kodem La'isha. He does not bring that as a rule. So according to the Rambam, there is no priority to save a man over a woman, whereas according to the Mishnah, there is such a priority. But practically speaking, when we come to a battlefield or to a disaster area, we don't choose who to treat first according to this hierarchy for various reasons, and I'll come in a minute to explain how do we do it today practically, halachically and ethically. There's another famous source in the Gemara Bava Metzia, two people who go in the desert and they have only one pint of water, which is enough to save one of the two, and the one that owns the water, what should he do? Should he drink all the water and save his life, knowing that his fellow friend will die, or should he divide it and perhaps both of them will die? But he should not take all for himself and give a chance to his friend. So that's a famous machlokes between Ben Ptura and Rabbi Akiva, and according to most poskim, we hold, according to Rabbi Akiva, that my life takes precedence over my fellow's life, and if in a situation where I have the source to save myself, and by using it for myself to save myself, someone else will die, that is how we should act. When I say we should, that by itself is debatable. Is it an obligation that I have to save my life and I can't even be a nice person and divide it in order to help someone else? Or am I allowed to save myself first, but if I want, I can do a noble act and try to help my friend even though I'm endangering myself? This is a debatable issue amongst the poskim. But that, as clear as it is stated by Ben Ptura and Rabbi Akiva, is almost irrelevant to current circumstances. And the reason is that here we talk about someone that the source of saving a life belongs to him. The water belongs to a person, and he is either obligated or allowed to save himself even though his friend will die. In most instances of triage decisions, the source of saving lives does not belong to the saver. The saver is safe. He doesn't need it. It is me saving two other people. Who do I choose between them? That is doesn't follow from this source. So that is a different debate. So if we don't use the Mishnah in Horayot, and if we don't use the Gemara in Bava Metzia, how do we triage amongst several people who I need to be saved? So you can go by first come, first serve. I come to the disastrous area. The first one that I encounter, I try to save him. I succeeded fine, or I didn't succeed fine, and once I finish with him, I go to the next one. Or do I do it by chance or by lottery? I draw a coin, and whoever the coin falls on, I start treating him. Or I go by medical criteria. Whoever is sicker or more seriously endangered takes priority, and whoever is less endangered is not. And do we take social or other criteria to save certain people amongst those who are injured because they are important to me or important to society or for many other reasons? So these are the four options, and which of them is the correct one? And the answer is the correct one is to start with by medical criteria. And what we do in this priority, we look at the severity of the injuries, we look at the chances of survival, and we look to the time that is required for treatment, and then we start treating. So what we do in the Israeli army, and I'm sure it's done in many armies in the world, and that is halachically been validated by many poskim, when we see, let's say, 20 injured people in a disaster terrorist attack, we have 20 people that were injured. We don't start treating anyone. We just look at all the injured, and we choose those who are in a life endangered situation, but the treatment will be most likely successful and quick. So the best example is someone who is bleeding from an arterial bleed. All I need to do is put a tourniquet and his life would be saved, and I did it quickly, and I can go on to someone else. If there is someone who is so severely injured that I have to intubate him, and I have to work on him all the time, so the time that I'll use for this one, many others will die because I won't have time for them. Or if someone has a scratch, I don't go to bandage him, he can survive even if I don't do anything to him. So the three criteria are the severity, the chance to survival, and how much time it requires to treat. And only then do I start to treat according to these priorities, provided all of them came at once. And I have all of them in front of me, and now I try to treat them. What about if amongst those that are injured are relatives or close friends to me? Do I prioritize them because personally, it's a brother, it's a sister, it's a father, what do I do? So ethicists say, who cares? You are not serving your family, you are serving society. So if your relative is injured in a way that is not prioritized by these three criteria, you have to skip him and you have to treat someone else. But that doesn't take into account the emotional state of the person who is treating. It's almost impossible to preach such an ethics and someone will really follow it. If you have someone who is very close to you, you naturally will treat him even if he doesn't fit exactly to this criteria. And indeed, amongst the poskim, many poskim say that you start treating the one who is closest to you as a relative. That is a priority statement. Now, if there are many injured in different locations, then the principle is try to get to the location where there are more people that you can save. There was a famous incident in one of the wars in the city of Tzor in Lebanon, where a building of two stories collapsed by a bomb, and they knew that in the bottom level there were just a few soldiers, and on the bottom level there were many soldiers, most of the soldiers were there, and on the second level there were a few soldiers. And the question was, in order to save the many, you have really to wipe out the upper surface in order to get to them. But by doing so, you're sacrificing the few that are there. So what should you do? Should you start treating the few there? And even if you succeed, most of the soldiers that are in the bottom won't survive because by the time you get there, they'll be dead. Or are you allowed to really wipe out the upper level in order to get to the bottom? A serious emotional, ethical, and halachic question, debatable, but that was an incident. So there are many such examples that we can look at a little later.
What does the poskim say in that case?
Well, so there's a debate between Rabbi Zilberstein and Rabbi Israeli. Rabbi Zilberstein, based on the Chazon Ish, which is not so clear that he really said what Rabbi Zilberstein understood he said that our obligation is to save the many, even on the expense of the few. So his psak was to wipe out the upper level and get quickly to the lower level. According to Rabbi Israeli, you can't kill even one in order to save many. If you have two separate buildings, in one building there are many, and in the other building there are few, you can go to the building of the many. But if it's in one building, and in order to get to the many, you have to sacrifice the few, that, he thought, is not allowed to do. And if you look at the Chazon Ish, probably he was closer to Rabbi Israeli than what Rabbi Zilberstein understood. It's an interesting debate. Now, let's look at the other side of the coin, the pursuer, the terrorist who did the act, and he was injured, not killed. And we have many such incidents. We experienced them practically in Jerusalem, where terrorists attacked, they were shot, but they weren't killed. We have now, I'm sure you all are aware of the trial that goes on a soldier who finished one of these terrorists while he was unarmed. Only I think in Israel would be such a trial going on for so long, someone who tried to save his and his fellow's life, and he's accused of murder. But that's some kind of ethics. But let's look at it from a halachic point of view. So the idea is of a roidev, right? Someone who is trying to kill someone else. What do you do to him in order to save, to rescue the one that is pursued? So harodef achar chavero leorgo, if you see someone pursuing after someone else to kill, everyone is obligated to save the one that is pursued from the pursuer, even if you have to kill the pursuer. But if you can save the one that is being pursued by inactivating the pursuer by not killing him, but by injuring him so that he will not be able to kill, like to break his leg or to make him blind, you have to do that and not kill him. But if you can't do it, then you are allowed to kill him even though he did not yet kill. That is a special halachic ruling that a roidev that did not yet do the act for which he should be punished is being punished. That is very unusual in halachic criteria. You kill someone who killed. You stone someone who was a Mechal Shabbos. But if someone says, I'm intending to be Mechal Shabbos, you don't kill him before he did the act. But here, at the Roidev, you don't wait for him to kill someone, you kill him even before he did the act. But if you can save the person that is being pursued by taking him out without killing, then you should do that. That is the rule of a Roidev. So from here we learn that once captured and unarmed, we are not allowed to kill, because that's what the Rambam says. If we could save the person from being pursued, then once you did it, you don't have to kill him anymore if he's not endangering anymore. And the same holds true if you captured him and he is now unarmed, you can torture him only to the degree that is needed to save others. But if you can't extract from him any more information, or you know that he doesn't know any more information, you're not allowed to torture him just for the sake of torturing. And again, if he's wounded, you are obligated to treat him. That is a bit questionable. If time permits, I'll get into it, but I'll give you a few examples. And when there are scarce resources and we have to triage, if the pursuer, the terrorist, and the victim are both in life endangering situation, then the victim takes precedence and you treat first the victim, and only after you save the victim, if the terrorist is still alive, you treat him and try to save him. But that is if both are endangered, if their lives are in danger. So there was a situation in Israel where a terrorist ran over with his car several people who were standing in a bus stop. He was shot. He was severely injured, but he didn't die. And both a person that was run over by the car, a victim that was a bystander, came to Shaare Tzedek with a broken leg, and the terrorist came with multiple gun injuries with a life-endangering situation. What do you do in this situation? Do you treat first the broken leg because that's the victim and you take care of him? Or do you treat first the terrorist because if you won't treat him right now, he'll die? We debated it and we decided to treat the terrorist first because his life was in danger and the broken leg can wait, and nothing will happen to the person with a broken leg. We managed to save the life of this terrorist. He was then tried and imprisoned, and then we treated the broken leg. We got a lot of critique. Why do we treat a terrorist who intended to kill, and here we save his life? The concept that we followed was that once a person, and we're talking about a person, a human being, bad or good or indifferent, enters a medical facility, he becomes a patient. And we as physicians have an obligation to treat patients. We can't judge the judges will judge whether he should be killed or imprisoned or whatever punishment he will get. And one of the reasons was that we had another incident where several people came into the hospital, and one of them, a dark-faced person, severely injured, unconscious, was identified as the terrorist. And some of the staff said, so let's put him aside, let him die, and we'll treat the other ones. We decided to treat him. And it turned out that it was a mistaken identification. It was one of the victims. He was a Jewish person, a Yemenite, who looked a little dark, but that is not a reason to die, right? And we treated him, and we saved his life as a victim. So such things can happen. We don't have the time. It's nice to sit in a hall and discuss it theoretically, but when there's a rushing of so many severely injured people, when you start to think who you treat and who you don't treat based on philosophies, you may lose people. And therefore, the idea is, that was our decision, that we treat according to a triage medical decision, and then whoever was treated turns out to be the terrorist will be handed over to the police and will be judged by judges, not by us, not by physicians. Obviously, again, I'm saying that if the victim and the terrorist are both in a life and danger situation and we can identify the terrorist without a mistake, we will treat first the victim. That goes without saying. But if the victim is not in a life endangering situation, we decided, after a lot of debates, to treat. And again, I don't have a halachic source to say that this is the right decision. I don't know any source, not to say it's right, not to say it's wrong. But I think from experience, that came out to be the best way to treat the situation. And hopefully, we will not need any more such decisions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Steinberg. So this evening what we are trying to do is look through the, what we do typically on Thursday evening at the opening session is to look through the year and see what sort of issues are confronting us as a Jewish community in the medical field in particular. And for our next talk, we're going to be discussing a little bit about the topic of organ transplantation. With us this evening is Rabbi Bolka, who I'm happy to say we have a very personal relationship. He was our Mar D'Asra, takes us back to Ottawa when I was in medical school here. Where's Rabbi Bolka now? There, somewhere? Ah, there he is. So for those of you that, I just had to put this up, I'm sorry to indulge, but I figure I have the floor. That's my daughter Rina, and that's Rabbi Bolka, and she was a very good student, I understand, right? So this goes back about 29 years to be exact. Rabbi Bolka has been the rabbi in the city. I don't know how many people can boast such a record, probably for about a half a century to be in the same shul. I tried to get the secret of the board, but I don't know if we can get that information. But it's really a pleasure, not only on a personal level to be able to introduce to you our former Mar D'Asra, but has become a real friend of the family and just a wonderful mentor over the many years. He is so involved in so many areas of not just in the city of Ottawa, but in Canada in general. He is actually one of the few people that I actually know that is actually a member of the Order of Canada, that I could say I actually know somebody on that to have that distinction. But he speaks very prolifically and passionately about the idea of organ transplantation, and he himself is the founding president and CEO of Kind Canada. So he has been dedicated in many ways to organ transplantation in particular. He's written so many books over the years. He does this on his brief travels to Israel back and forth, which he has done over the years and regaled us. It's really a wonderful pleasure to introduce to you Rabbi Gbolka.
So with your permission, I'd like to follow Rabbi Steinberg, not only in terms of time, but also in terms of not using the podium. Are you okay with that? Okay, good. So that means that I have to carry my notes in front of me. Not that much, but you'll be surprised. It's probably worth at least a half an hour. So to begin with, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here as... I've been waiting 50 years for this to happen in Ottawa, and it's a delight to welcome you all to the city, and special welcome to Laser and to Shana, who, if I had to measure this, I don't know if there's a way of measuring it, but if I had to measure it, when measure the disappointment when a member of the shul leaves the city and goes to another city, I would have to rank them as right at the very top in terms of how disappointed we were when they left, because we realized the quality of the people and how much we missed them then when they left, but how delighted I am to see them flourishing in Toronto with their children. The picture that he showed you, I don't know if that picture would be legal today, of a rabbi holding a young lady on his lap, but I'm happy it happened so many years ago, so I didn't get in trouble for it. Very interesting, too, and delighted to welcome Rabbi and Mrs. Kelman. I have had the pleasure of knowing Rabbi Jay for quite a long time, and I remember all the way back that he always had this passionate desire to go beyond what is expected and to really make an impact within the Jewish community. And he has definitely done so in so many different ways. I don't know if he realizes also that his impact has been far beyond that. You know that we have many sports teams in Toronto, the Toronto Maple Leafs, I don't know if you call them a team, but he is one of the few people who can say that I had a baseball team named after him, because the Jays are Toronto's baseball team. Now, if you come from America, you probably don't know, but Yasher Koyach, this is a great achievement. Tonight, we are honored, the city, with the coming together into the city from so many different places of so many great intellects, Tamidei Chachamim, people who have done extraordinary work in terms of advancing the field of medical ethics. It reminds me of the story that is attributed to John F. Kennedy, that one day he woke up with a dream that he wanted to invite all of the Nobel Prize winners in the United States to a dinner at the White House. So, kahava, you know, when you're the president of the United States and you want something, it happens. So he had a great convocation of all of these scientists, doctors, you name it, that came, And he began by welcoming them all, of course, and he said, this is the greatest conglomeration and coming together of intellect in the White House since the time that Thomas Jefferson dined here alone. Which, very interesting, nobody here is going to dine alone, but we have a great conglomeration of people who have come from so many places, and we're honored in the city to be able to enjoy all of you over the course of what will be a very, hopefully a very rewarding next few days. Let me get to the issue that we're supposed to be talking about now, which is why Jews do not donate. If I took the word Jew out for the moment and just add the question, rephrase the question in terms of why people don't donate, it is actually quite an interesting question. And the question is as valid for non-Jews as it is for Jews, except for Jews even more so. So let's begin with some of the facts, which you may be aware of. In the United States, 21 people die every day waiting for an organ. In New York alone, where many of you may be coming from, 500 people die a year waiting for an organ. There are about 10,000 people on the waiting list in New York alone. And the wait list seems to be continuing to get bigger and bigger, in spite of something which is quite interesting, namely that if you speak to people and say to them, do you support organ donation? So most of them will say absolutely. As a matter of fact, the percentage of people who say that they are in favor of organ donation is about 90%. But you then make a quick look at the people who have signed up to be organ donors, then unfortunately there are a little bit of a disappointment in that, because in some good places, you may have 50% of the population that signed up, but the average is somewhere between 25 and 30%. So how do you square off the fact that 90% of them think that it's a good thing, but only a quarter have actually signed up? So the obvious answer is they think it's a good thing, but for you, not for me. They think everybody else should do it, but they're not willing to make it as a commitment on their own. And that's one of the major problems that we have, which is why do you have this disparity? We're not talking about, let's say, dismissing them because they think it's a bad thing. They think it's a good thing, but they're not signing up. And the big question of why, and this is not a Jewish question, it's a question that affects Yidden, maybe a little bit more so if we assume, as Rabbi Steinberg has hinted, I don't want to put words in his mouth, that we're looking at something which may actually, I think it was Laser who spoke about the fact that it may be an obligation. Go backwards a little bit, not to organ donation, but something which was simple, which is blood donation. If I asked you a simple question, which is in Canada, and I suspect it's the same thing in the United States, what is the percentage of people in Canada of eligible donors? I'm not counting babies. I'm not counting people who have illnesses which disqualify them from being blood donors. I'm talking just about people who are eligible to be donors. What percentage of them are actually blood donors? So if I say 50, let's not waste your time with it. If the ugly statistic in Canada is less than 4% of people who are eligible to be donors, namely they're over 17, they're in good health, they're not over 70, and they don't have any illnesses that disqualify them, only less than 4% are actually blood donors. So on the one hand, I say to myself, I mean, that's inexcusable. On the other, they say, so why should I fret about organ donation statistics when on something which is much more easy, and we're talking about not being a donor every 2 weeks or every 7 weeks or whatever the case may be, whether it's for platelets or whatever, we're talking about, let's say, doing it once a year. And even on that, you only have less than 4%. So there's something that is getting in the way of people in terms of actually doing something. So with blood donation, I can tell you that people are cracking their heads, trying to figure it out. I'm not sure what they're going to figure out. They've been at this for so many, many years. They're trying to overcome it, but it's not an easy fix. So with blood, some of people are saying, you know what, it takes time. It takes time away. Usually the clinics are open during the day. It's work. It's a big sacrifice to make. I'm not sure that making a sacrifice of 1 hour, even once a year, is such a big deal. But then again, this is one of the things that they're suggesting. Let me share with you, because this has been looked at on a secular level, some of the reasons why people don't donate organs. And we're not talking actually about donating the organs, we're talking about signing up to donate the organs. We do know something very important in terms of my involvement with Trillium Gift of Life Network, which is that the percentage of people who are eligible to donate organs who have signed up to be organ donors, they're twice as likely as people who have not signed up to actually land up being donors. So that's a very important thing. Signing up is not just simply an exercise of saying, okay, count me in. And then when the time comes, it becomes totally irrelevant. It is very relevant to what's going to happen down the road. So here are some of the things that are going on in the secular world. Number one, people don't have enough of a seichel to understand what does it mean to be brain dead. So it doesn't. They're not in the Yiddish language. They're not teufis it. They don't get it. You wonder whether they're not brain dead when they're alive, but the brain dead thing just doesn't enter. They don't understand the idea that you actually can look alive because the machines are on and you look like you're okay and you're breathing, but actually you're not around. You're not there. So some people have a difficulty with that. Another interesting finding is that many of the people who do not donate don't trust the medical profession. I hate to say this. I'm only reporting. Don't shoot the messenger. It's not that they are not trustworthy. It's that some of them don't. They're afraid, some of them, that if they have signed up to be a donor, that they're going to get minimized care. Because the doctors will say, oh, potential donor, and my friend, my doctor, he's looking for a kidney or a liver or a heart, and this fellow or lady might qualify, so why shouldn't I, just basically neglect so that they die and everything will be fine. So there are some people who really think that this is happening, even though in Ontario for sure, and probably in all those constituencies, doctors yell up and down that this is not the case, that there is an actual cutoff between donation and transplantation, and never the twain shall meet. But still, we're talking not about things that are rational and logical, we're talking about why people don't go. The next one is going to floor you. Grey's Anatomy is the reason why people don't give organs. People are watching Grey's Anatomy, they get an idea about some of the crazy things that happen in the medical field, and they believe some of the nonsense that is reported, and therefore they say, I'll have nothing to do with it. Another interesting one is that, you know, there are no atheists in foxholes when a person is about to leave this world. So even if they may not have been that religious during their lifetime, they go with the assumption that religions are against us. This not only in the Jewish religion, but all sorts of religions. Even though we have worked so hard to make sure that every single one of the major religions puts out a brochure which says very clearly how they feel about it, and they're very clear about it. It doesn't seem to make a difference for many people. One of the other issues is what's called the ick factor. Like it's yuck. I just don't like the idea of being cut up after I'm gone. And basically included in this is the fear that has not been articulated as clearly, but it seems to be that a lot of people think that they will feel the pain, even though they're dead. They may feel the pain of the organ being, the word that we use is harvested, I don't like the word, but basically the organ removed in order to implant it into someone else.
So that too is a little bit of what you would call an ikuf. And there's some other irrational things, like such people think, a significant amount in a poll of about 4,000 individuals, which included college-age students and others, they actually felt that by talking about this, they will hasten their demise. You will say it's meshuggah, but again, we're not talking necessarily about things that are rational. And I could stop here and say, okay, so you now have a little bit of a picture of the landscape amongst the general population. So let's now move quickly into what about Jewish people. So we have other reasons why, which have come up all over the place over the course of time, and no matter how much you write about this, and no matter how much you scream about it, and no matter how much Rabbi Jay will write editorials in the Canadian Jewish News to say that it's nonsense, somehow or other, there's this thing in the head which is hard to undo. So, let me begin also with just say as a caveat. We're frustrated because there are people that are dying on a waiting list. On the other hand, if you take a look at it from the big picture, if I'm doing it, let's say, as a defense attorney, I would say, this is a new kid on the block, relatively. The idea of being able to transplant organs is something very new. In Canada, I mean, kidney transplantation doesn't have a history of 100 years. So you can actually perhaps excuse this in terms of the fact that the generations that have grown up until now have not grown up with a culture of donating. They've grown up with a simple culture, which is when a person, chas v'shalom, passes away, what you do is you do burial immediately and totally of the entire human being. And there are some people who, to this very day, they can't get around that and say, why should it be different? Even though we keep on telling them that hatzolos nefoshos, it actually, I usually to say it trumps this, but I have to use a different word now. But saving of lives actually overrides all of these very important values and very important considerations. But ein l'chodova sh'omed b'tnei pikuach nefesh. There's nothing that really, aside from the big three, but nothing should stand in the way of saving lives. So there are other issues that have come up, like, for example, if you want immediate burial for a person who has passed away, that cannot happen with organ donation because there's a process and it takes time. It doesn't necessarily have to take a lot of time, but obviously the immediacy of burial is going to be compromised. Again, saving of life is overrides that. Then there's another issue which will probably come up in my discussion tomorrow, which is the question of, are you allowed to derive any benefit from a person who has died? I know from a mace. And obviously we are getting big benefit in terms of life saving, but again, this is overridden by the idea of saving of lives. There are other issues that have come up. I don't know that if you took a poll of individuals and asked them whether this would ever come up as their reason for it, but things that if you read in halachic literature, which are a little bit scary. So for example, the suggestion has been made that when a person's organ is taken out from them, they're not really fully gone. And so that, for example, the idea of their death being an atonement, that doesn't actually start until the organ or organs that were taken out, they actually die too. In other words, it's as if to say that this person's death doesn't mean that he's totally gone. His atonement is in abeyance until whatever, whether it be a kidney or a heart or whatever that's given to someone else, is actually gone. So if a person, let's say, makes a multi-organ donation after death, his kapora could be a long way off if you buy into that. But if a person sees this or hears this, then immediately it sets off bells in the head and says, why should I do this? Why should I compromise my atonement for a stranger that I don't even know? There's another scary scenario that is written in a very respected halachic source, that if a person donates an organ during their lifetime, on their deathbed, and it comes out after they've died, that it's very possible that that individual will come to Olam Haba without, in other words, without that organ. So, for example, can imagine this, if let's say a person donated cornea, that they would, in the Olam HaEmes, upstairs, they would not have eyes. It came from a normally reputable source. And again, I don't think anybody out there is aware of it. It's not actually normative, but when you read it, you get scared. So added to all of the other reasons why other people will not donate their organs, this one actually just makes it even worse. So, but I would tend to think that if you really want to zero in on the main thing, it's the fact that we have this ongoing dispute about what constitutes dying, what constitutes dead. Is it a cardiac death? Is it a brainstem dead? What means brainstem dead? All that machloket, that difference of opinion, it may be academic for the people that are arguing it, but obviously more than academic. But for people who are contemplating this, they say, why should I get into some sort of difficulty on this issue? I don't want to have my Olam Haba compromised on the technicality. So basically they say, forget it. I'll just go ahead and do what everyone else has done for all the generations, and I won't get into this. So we have somehow or other to confront this question of what is it that's going on here. I think you have a pretty good idea now of some of the difficulties that are going on in people's minds about whether they should do it. And it was very interesting, I think it was in Tzitz Eliezer, he made an interesting comment. He said, no one expects a rabbi to do something like this, which is interesting. And so therefore he said, if no one expects a rabbi to do it, then it would be unfair for anyone who is not a rabbi to have to be forced into doing it. This is interesting logic. If you make all the assumptions, I mean, we can easily buy into the idea that in Jewish law, the obligations, the mitzvot, they are equal to everyone. We have to put on the same tefillin, we have to put the same talis, whatever it is. So this idea, whether it's true or not, I'm not sure, but I want to conclude, because this was sort of like a jumping off point to a very interesting and simple conclusion. We take it for granted today, for example, that when a person passes away, that they are buried in tachrichim, in shrouds. This did not actually reflect the reality in pre-Talmudic times. And even in Talmudic times, as much as there was a concern about the pressures that were placed upon the poor people, who were simply unable to keep up with the richer ones who had more lavish funerals, and there was a concern about it, and so the idea of having a common, simple burial gained credibility, but it didn't become a norm in the Jewish community until someone of the stature of Rabbi Gamliel said, I want to be buried that way. And when he was buried that way, that sort of broke the ice and said, it's not that the rabbis are saying it's for you, it's the rabbis are saying, no, it's for me too. And if it's good for the rabbis, it's good for everyone else. And I have a strong suspicion that all of the doubts that we have about how we're going to move this forward, nothing will work as much as the Godol Hador, whoever it may be, saying that La'achameh ve'esrim, I want to donate my organs to someone else. It's going to take a Maisa Rav like that to actually fulfill what we have in this week's Pirkei Avot, which is Aseh Lecha Rav Histalek Min HaSofek. Until that happens, I think we're going to continue to wrestle with trying to undo public perceptions and Jewish perceptions about the issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Volka. Maaser Rav, but that would be. So, you'll notice that Torah in Motion also has, besides doing medical ethics conferences, they also travel the world. You'll notice that we were thinking perhaps of doing this one in an exotic place like Brazil, but that idea was shot down pretty early with all of what's going on. So I'm not sure who's going to be going to Brazil or not, and it brings up a tremendous question. But that, of course, is going to be, can we go? Can we compete? So whether you're Russian or you're not, that's a whole different story. We'll leave that for a different time. But we will be discussing, though, the important question, which is, can people go to Rio, whether it be to compete, to visit? It's an interesting comment. I mean, we're in the car today driving, and there was a comment that came up and said, my daughter doesn't want to go to Florida this winter, and somehow or other she has this idea that would be a risk. So the question is, how far does this issue come about? In order to address a question of this nature, we've asked Rabbi Aaron Galat to address this. Now, Rabbi Galat is a wonderful friend of Torah in Motion, and over the years, I'm very happy to say that we've become very close friends, and him and his wife Margie have been part of our conferences over the years. And it's truly a wonderful honor to have both of you with us this evening. For those that know Rabbi Galat, you know that he is a wonderful speaker, highly involved in community affairs, and is, as you can read in the bio, which would take longer than the time that I have allotted, very, very much involved. He is a rabbi in shul in New York. In addition, he of course is, as you know, a practicing clinical physician. So from this perspective, he brings with him a lot of that very much involvement that he has, both at the rabbinic level and as well from a clinical level. And this is an area, being an expert in infectious disease, he has been very involved in on a professional level in terms of infectious disease, not only writing chapters and books and in major textbooks, but having been heads of organizations that deal with infectious disease. So we truly have with us a rabbinic expert who is an expert in clinical infectious diseases, who will be able to help make some heads or tails of this controversial question. It's my pleasure to call upon Rabbi Galat.
Thank you very, very much. To echo the words of the previous speakers, I want to thank the Kelmans and the Friedmans and all Torah in Motion. We're only here 7 out of 8 years, so we haven't made the Chazaka yet. But this is a wonderful, wonderful conference. It's truly our honor and pleasure to be here. I'll be giving all the shiurim that I'll be giving over this time. Lili Nishmas, my mother, who was unfortunately just nifter, and Chana Bas Meir Avrom, Harinina Kahoris Mishkova, should be in Aliyah for Neshama, all the Torah that we'll learn in Yitzhak Hashem over the next few days. So what's the buzz on Zika? So this is a very, very important halachic shayla. I have gotten more medical halachic shaylas about Zika than any other question in medical halacha in the last couple of weeks, months, since Pesach, Erev Pesach. So Michael Phelps is going to be in the news probably over the next few days. He's quoted as saying, "I won't be the first person to bring Zika to Arizona, but I'll definitely be the best swimmer to bring Zika to Arizona." And he stated, the World Health Organization, WHO, says we have nothing to worry about. So therefore, there's no reason to worry. I don't know if that's true. There's dengue, chikungunya, now there's Zika. It's a very, very important viruses, but from a halachic point of view, chikungunya, dengue don't pose anywhere near the halachic shailas that Zika does. And these are all just a small sampling of the real shailas I've been asked about Zika over the last few months. So this is starting from before Pesach. I got numerous questions about, can I go away on vacation? To Florida was a frequently asked question. But there were many people that were asking me about going to South America, Central America, Mexico. I was asked twice about Eretz Yisrael. And then I was also asked by people who weren't going there on vacation, but they were going there to work. As a mashgiach, going there for business, for various other parnassa-related issues. Are they allowed to go to those places? And what are the shailas that come up? On many occasions I was asked, my husband just came back from either work or pleasure from a Zika area. Specifically, the first one I was asked was from Brazil, and the wife said, I'm pregnant. Now, Beis Din called me up, who was deliberating what they should do in this situation. None of the rabbanim felt comfortable. They didn't know the facts. Never mind, even once you know the facts, the halacha is not so clear. And in this situation, she stated, my frum obstetrician says I have to use a condom. Another shaila, relocation in Panama, I'm trying to have a child. And my frum obstetrician says we have to use a condom. My children are visiting from South America. Are we at risk? And just about every other variation on this question. So this is an extremely critically important shaila that has, for reasons that I'm not clear, not gotten the halachic attention that I might have thought it would have in the published literature. So I don't have a lot of time. I don't want to go into a great depth about the medical background. These slides are all in your books if anybody has questions about it. For practical purposes, for those that are not physicians, this is a virus that can cause a whole bunch of different illnesses that are similar to this virus from this class of viruses called the flaviviridae. That's all the medicine I'm going to go through for now. Any of the doctors or other people that have questions about this, answer show, happy to answer them at any time. It's not essential to know the halacha. What's possibly the most interesting thing about Zika is that in the 40th year of the Nais in Entebbe, so Zika was first isolated near Entebbe. So there are two reasons why Jewish people should know about Entebbe. So we just had literally on July 4th, the 40th anniversary of that truly great Nais, all the hostages were freed, or almost all. There were a couple of deaths in Entebbe, but that was 40 years ago on July 4th, and in 1947, Zika was first isolated. Not much of interest from a medical, and certainly not from a halachic point of view, and again, I will go rush through some of the medical stuff that's not essential to understand the halacha, but you can look at it in the slide kits. But this really became very, very important in 2015. When in Brazil and now at least 40 other countries, you have to literally give this talk and do an internet search right before you give the talk to make sure that there aren't new things. I have two new things, and I checked the internet this morning just to make sure that I wouldn't be out of date already, and there were two new things that I can add. So this is an absolutely changing, dynamic medical process. And there are now well over 100,000 cases of actual cases of Zika in the world. And this is a mosquito vector again. I'm going to jump through some of this. For those of us that live south of Canada, so this is something that will come to the United States, at least in theory. There are two major mosquito species, and this is their historical pattern over here in where these mosquitoes go up to. And this is an important area for me because that's where I live. And notice that that's potentially an area where mosquitoes can transmit Zika. Now, this slide clearly states mosquito Zika has not yet been reported in the United States. So this morning, there are two cases in Florida that have now been identified, and they're not sure how Zika was transmitted to those two people. They did not have a travel history. There's a case in Utah that's being investigated, and this is a constantly changing medical situation, which has obvious ramifications in halacha. Now, how is Zika normally transmitted? This is essential for the halacha. Sorry. So, the classical way that it is transmitted is from mosquito bites in an endemic area. Right now, forget the two cases that I mentioned that may be transmitted in Florida from endemic Zika transmission, but in the United States right now, and certainly not in our northern neighbor, Canada, there is no endemic Zika. That doesn't mean there aren't cases. The United States has over 500-600 cases of Zika, but they've all been people that have traveled from a Zika endemic area to the United States, and also sexual acquisition in the United States has been reported, as well as in many other places that aren't Zika endemic, because if a person goes to an endemic area and has Zika in them, they can transmit it sexually. And that's the huge difference between Zika and the other flaviviruses. Dengue is not a sexually transmitted disease. West Nile is not a sexually transmitted disease. Zika is a sexually transmissible disease, and that is critical. And the other thing that makes Zika halachi shaila is that it can be transmitted from mother to baby, and unfortunately it causes a horrific potential problem in the baby called microcephaly. These reasons, the sexual transmission and the intrauterine transmission, make this a phenomenally difficult and important halachic shaila that has not been true with any of the other flaviviridae. There are a number of interesting other theoretical ways that it can be transmitted, which I won't go into right now. Again, if the physicians or anyone else has questions about some of these things, you can look at in the books and ask me about them either afterwards or anytime over the weekend. So, the clinical course in the person who gets it, not really much seriousness. If we only had males, wouldn't be a problem, because they don't really get very sick. And the women also don't get very sick themselves. There is no specific treatment necessary, and it usually is self-limited. Fatalities are very rare. There are a couple of questions of some rare neurological diseases that have been discussed, Guillain-Barré, maybe some others. Not really a medically, halachically important situation. What is, as I mentioned, is microcephaly. That's a critical situation. Over 4,000 babies never have been born already with microcephaly. And we just had the first case born in New York about 3 days ago. Now, again, this was a patient who had acquired Zika in an endemic area. Now we know that earlier in the pregnancy, exposure is much more serious. So this has halachic ramifications, because if a woman is in the third trimester, they really have now pretty much identified that there's very limited, as far as we can tell, risk. And therefore, the halachic questions that would arise in a woman in the third trimester of pregnancy if her husband has Zika, I think, no longer are shilas. From a medical point of view, that's eliminated the halachic shilas that would be asked if the woman was in the first or second trimester of pregnancy. So again, the medical facts always need to be taken into account when you make any halachic pronouncement. The CDC has not yet changed their official recommendation, so if doctors are following what the CDC says rather than what the Torah Shabbat Peh says, so therefore, that's going to be putting from doctors or from practitioners at odds with their professional organizations, professional societies, versus what the Torah would demand in that situation. What is really scary is what should be policies for governments. And the country of El Salvador has actually made a recommendation that you should not get pregnant until 2018. Because of the concerns of Zika-related microcephaly. This has huge halachic ramifications for anybody Jewish living in those areas, as well as for other countries, because the World Health Organization has essentially mimicked what El Salvador has said. And people living in areas with Zika circulating should consider delaying pregnancy. This is a halachically difficult statement to just simply make. And we have to explore, does it have any halachic basis or not? And they continued and say, with no vaccine yet available, there are studies underway that are just starting within the last week or so as well, and with limited ability to really control the mosquito population, delaying pregnancy may be the best way. In affected areas, to avoid having children with severe brain damage. This means that if you follow the World Health Organization, and the CDC has essentially the same recommendation in the United States, so then you're basically telling every single foreign person in an endemic area don't have children. So what does the halacha have to say about that? So first question that I think is critical is, what does halacha have to say about doing an abortion in this situation? So you have to know the facts. So this was a study published less than a month ago, an Israeli study, and tremendous pride in the medical studies that are going on in Eretz Yisrael, that now we have better testing for Zika, which is very important. And the testing is actually best done not on the serum, but it's actually on whole blood, they showed, then on urine, and then on serum. So depending on what you're testing, that will impact what the halacha will tell you to do. another test, which until very, very recently was not recommended by the CDC, but this answers a tremendous amount of the halachic questions. And when I suggested this to a number of rabbonim, as well as doctors, I got a lot of flack because that wasn't the CDC recommendation. But Baruch Hashem, the CDC now does recommend that you do IgM testing. And what, for the non-physicians as well as for physicians, this is a test that you can detect if a person, a man, let's say, who's been in a Zika endemic area, if he doesn't have clinical evidence of disease, and his IgM test is negative at least 1 week, but up to 12 weeks after the leaving of the endemic area, and it's negative, so then this essentially rules out that the person could transmit Zika through the zera, through his semen, to his wife, who may be trying to get pregnant or is already pregnant. And therefore, I was asked numerous times by the Beisdin, by Rabbonim, had to discuss this with a number of major poskim, and based upon this medical information, if the negative IgM test is present, the patient has not been exposed to Zika. The CDC did not officially recognize this until about 2 weeks ago. They still would recommend that such a person use a condom. Halacha would not allow that in that situation. From observations in the cases that I mentioned, we're following the CDC's advice, but Mani Azdati, not following what the halacha would do with the interpretation of the data that the CDC advised. Again, looking at it from a non-Hashkafic Jewish point of view, what's the problem with a pregnant woman using a condom? How does that impact anything? The pregnant woman using a condom. In the non-Jewish world, in the non-firm world, what's the big deal? But in the Orthodox world, there is an issur for a pregnant woman and her husband to use a condom. There still is an issue of hashkasa zera, and this is a huge problem. I had a discussion with Rabbi Leich Shlita, one of the major poskim, about this. Under almost no circumstances, he willing to permit a condom, even in situations far more likely to cause problems than this case, where there is, in my medical opinion, zero risk of transmitting Zika. And yet the CDC officially still to this date recommends that you use a condom. Because to them it doesn't make a difference that a pregnant woman uses a condom. They can't understand the chashash of hashkas zera batala in a woman who's already pregnant. And many Jewish people and many firm people don't understand the nuances as well, but it's absolutely also under normal circumstances. And with the exception of Chaim Lozer Grzinski, that's out. And a very unique chiddush that he had in this area, the vast, vast, vast majority of poskim are very, very, very reluctant to ever permit the usage of a condom except under the most extreme conditions, including in this situation, where Bleich would not permit it under any circumstance. And the discusses with Usher Weiss, Shlita, Mordechai Willig, and other great gedolim, they would be permitting under rare and certain circumstances only to use a condom in these situations. But we'll get to that more in a second. But right now we're talking about abortion. So if the mother, Rachmana Litzlan, does in fact have Zika, so what should you do? So we don't know what the real risk is to the baby. The medical information we have right now is only, Baruch Hashem, 1 in 100 babies born to a Zika-infected mother will have microcephaly. So that in halacha is already a miyuta. Small percentage. Nobody where Rahman al-Islam wants to be that 1%, assuming that number is even accurate. That's a question how accurate that number is. We can't do serial sonograms. And if the serial sonograms don't show any evidence, then Baruch Hashem, the children have been born, they haven't had significant medical problems. Now, we can't say that they won't have problems when they're 5 years old with ADD, but that's certainly not a hazard to do an abortion. And if you do find that there is very severe disease based on serial sonogram, so I've discussed this with several poskim as well, and under certain situations they would consider sanctioning an abortion and others would not. It's a famous tshuva from Rav Ozner Zatzal, the great Shemin HaLevi, who was nifter a little bit more than a year ago. And he basically had this question asked to him when rubella vaccine was first brought on board 50 years ago. And they gave rubella vaccine unintentionally to a lot of young women who were pregnant, or early in the stage of pregnancy. There was the concern that the babies would be born with some terrible machel because you're basically giving them rubella, which is a very dangerous situation to give to a pregnant woman. And His trooper says that his Beis Din was asked 1,000 such shilas. He's a printed trooper in the Shein Olay. 1,000 such shilas, and he did not matir an abortion in even one case. He writes at the end of the trooper that not 999 of those 1,000 real cases, not a theoretical number. 999, the babies were born Baruch Hashem healthy. In one baby, there was some minor abnormality. Maybe or maybe not, it was attributed to the virus. And he didn't matter a single abortion. Now, I'm not saying it's analogous to this situation. Again, discussed this with some great poskim who would if they saw on serial sonograms that the baby was Rahman al-Litzlan severely impacted and would sanction an abortion maybe under those situations. But certainly if there is no evidence, and to just say, well, there's a 1 in 100 chance, let's do an abortion, so I don't think halacha or any poskim that I spoke with would matter such a situation. Now, these are the CDC recommendations over here. I went through some of this already. You have to change around so many things that impact the halacha. So it says, asymptomatic man rarely transmits Zika to his sexual partners. When I first put this slide together, it was asymptomatic men never transmit to their partners. I'm sorry for keeping on pressing the wrong button. They never transmit it. Now there's one case report from France where an asymptomatic man transmitted to his partner. It's been transmitted now. I used to say there were no women. I didn't have a chance to change this slide because it was printed already. No cases yet whereby women infected. A man via sex. Now there is one case report of that as well. So this is constantly changing. This case report was about 2 weeks ago. So this is a real shiloh, what you do in these situations. It can be transmitted sexually. So the official CDC recommendation, if you've traveled to an endemic area, don't get pregnant. What about from people? How does this apply? So, does the halacha allow a condom or birth control? Under what conditions? And what are the halachic alternatives? So these are the official CDC recommendations. Woman is pregnant. Her male partner traveled to Zika. For us, Baruch Hashem, this is the husband. Woman's pregnant. Her husband traveled to a Zika area. Use condoms or abstain from sex for the duration of the pregnancy. So, that poses huge halachic problems. If the male partner has confirmed Zika, they say use condoms or abstain for at least 6 months. If she's not pregnant, if she is pregnant for the entire pregnancy. If he doesn't have symptoms, they say to wait 8 weeks. All of these are huge halachic shailos. So what does the halacha say? So we have another shailah over here. They don't have any symptoms. You have to wait at least 8 weeks. What happens if they want to try to get pregnant? Again, they say wait 8 weeks if the woman went to the area, 6 months if the man went to the area. What does the halacha say? So again, this IgM test is critical. It only is available relatively recently. New York State Department of Health has had this test available for 4 months. New Jersey Department of Health didn't have it until about a month ago. So when I was asked Shilas from Lakewood about this, they didn't have the test available. They have to either come to New York or they did without it. So this is one of the most important discussions. And right now, it still has not officially changed the recommendations from the CDC. So for my obstetricians who are blindly following what the CDC says are, in my humble opinion, going connected what the halacha would say when they advise their patients in that situation. I'd like to just conclude with going over some of the lemaisa situations. Visiting an endemic area. For business, there is a heter. There's a famous heter from the Noda Yehuda. He wrote down, he's asked the Shiloh, can a person go hunting? Is a person permitted to, for parnasa purposes, do something that would be dangerous? And he clearly said yes. Can you be a person just going on a safari? And I think the Torah safaris that you guys do, but to go out into a hunting area, and you know, 99% of the time you're going to win, but 1% of the time the lion or the tiger is going to win. It's not like the Olympics, you just don't get the silver or the bronze. The tiger gets everything. So are you allowed to do something like that? So for business, the Noda Yehuda clearly says yes. When he has dati, for pleasure, for vacation, I think the answer is no. So all of those people, I mean, still get almost one question, two questions a week. Can I travel there? Can I travel there? So Lania's doctor, the answer is, and I told people who are of the age where they can still get pregnant, Either the husband has a wife who can still get pregnant, or it's the wife going to the area. So then they should not travel for business, for pleasure or vacation purposes to a Zika endemic area. That includes a lot of places. Right now it does not include Florida, but that might change. And one needs to be aware of the medical facts in order to give the halachic facts. Now, if somebody does travel there, then that entails a whole bunch of significant halachic problems. Once they come back, they didn't listen to advice, or they didn't ask a shayla. They put themselves into a situation for business, for halachic purposes, they have the right, for business purposes, they have the right to put themselves into that situation. And now the ramifications of that decision. So, again, for a short period of time, if you're talking about an 8-week period of time, so that I'm not aware of any posek that would allow the usage of a condom, for a 6-month period of time, assuming that they really were infected, and you can detect in the zera of a person remnants via PCR up to 62 days after the last time they left the endemic area. So the CDC has therefore recommended 6 months out of precaution. So there, some poskim would permit a condom to be used, and other poskim would still not permit a condom to be used. It would say that you should either abstain or shomer pesoy mashem. The risk and the likelihood is still significantly low in that situation that you would be allowed to take the chances if you wanted to, but wouldn't be allowed to use a condom. Now, if the woman is not yet pregnant, so then you don't need to use a condom. Then you can use other forms of contraception, which pose much less halachic problems. Of all the types of contraception, the condom probably is the most serious halachic violation. And there's a lot more room to be makel in terms of using birth control pills. Now, that will still allow the zera to get to the woman, but if she gets sick, it's only a mild disease. If she can't get pregnant, then there's no concern of getting microcephaly in the baby. So there are many more poskim that would permit in that situation a woman who's not yet pregnant to take contraception that's much less halachically difficult, such as taking a birth control pill, using a boch of some sort, and that would be an eitzah in those situations if she's not yet pregnant. If the woman's pregnant, using birth control pills would have absolutely no value. They'd be medically contraindicated anyway. You wouldn't want to do something like that. But the zera is the problem. The man's zera can infect the woman, even if she won't get pregnant, because she is already pregnant, but that Zika can then get into her body, and Rahman al-Islam get into the baby as well. So contraception would be potentially allowed in certain situations, but not with a condom in most situations. And again, the question would be for how long? The poskim that I've spoken with suggests that when it's a very short-term situation, no contraception should be used, and that the couple should abstain if they wish to abstain, that's fine. If they wish to have regular tashmish, that would be permitted because the risk is low enough. But they wouldn't be allowed for a very short period of time to use contraception. And again, the longer the period of time, that goes into a different type of a shiloh where certain types of contraception would already be permitted, and under some extenuating circumstances, some post would even permit a condom in that situation. Prophylactic abortion pre-day 40, I'm not aware of any posek that would sanction that automatically. If a woman just found out she's pregnant and she just came back from Brazil, this is Shiloh was asked to me. A woman came back from an endemic area. She didn't know she was pregnant at that time when she went there. She came back, she found out she was pregnant. What should she do? It's before day 40. So let me ask that. I don't think there's a hetter to go do an abortion in that situation. And the halachic response would be to go follow the pregnancy with serial sonograms and do testing. If there's no Baruch Hashem infection, then it's not even a shayla. Assuming she was truly infected, so then you would do serial sonograms, and then depending on the outcome of the serial sonograms, you'd have to make your halachic decision. And I stress that these aren't decisions that a physician should be making. These are decisions that a postnik should be making in consultation with a knowledgeable physician and making sure that you have all of the tests available. I mentioned already for a known microcephaly, there may be hetero to do an abortion. Again, a great posting needs to be discussed, and some of the posts seem to suggest also the difference in the severity of the microcephaly would impact on their decision to allow or not allow an abortion. And finally, the most important thing that we can do is prevention measures to make sure that people, when they do have to go to one of those areas, which is endemic, that they make sure that they take all of the shmarati modus nashosecha opportunities, staying away from areas where there is more endemicity, staying away from areas where there are bodies of water, where mosquitoes may bite, different times of the day. There's a whole bunch of preventative things in terms of webbing, netting that you can use in terms of putting appropriate DEET or other types of prophylactic creams and sprays on. So all of these things will be chiyuv and will be, in my opinion, if you have to go into those areas, something that you should pay a tremendous amount of attention to. So I've used up all of my time. I thank you very, very much for listening.
Every year, we generally try to look in the look around in terms of the general academic, whether it be universities and places that perhaps might bring a new face to our conference. And this year is no different than all the others. Sorry. Right, I'm introducing one. So. But this one, I have to say, I had some help. My son, who is at Einstein Medical School, heard our next speaker and said and made the recommendation. So when he called me up, said, "Dad, I think I have an idea for you." He was right with us a couple of years ago when he introduced to a different speaker. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce to you Rabbi Dr. Ira Bedzo. Rabbi Bedzo is an assistant professor of medicine and director of medical ethics unit at humanities program at New York Medical College. He received his PhD from Emory University and MA from Touro. He was very modest when I asked him to submit me your small bio. That's what he did. He submitted a small bio. Like I said, if you go through his CVs. He not only has Yora Yora, he also has Yadin Yadin. So in terms of his rabbinic qualifications, he certainly has the double type of smicha that many of you are familiar with. He's editor-in-chief of a quarterly journal as well, and he's already authored many books, but most importantly, he is an engaging speaker and highly knowledgeable, and it's my great pleasure to introduce to you Rabbi Dr. Bedzo, who will speak to us on the topic of, is Jewish medical ethics relevant for today's doctors?
First off, I want to thank you guys for bearing with me. Given the time, I will not speak at length and how grateful I am to be here, but just you should know that I am very grateful to you. I also want to thank Dr. Friedman in particular for his introduction, not the one about me, although that was great, but of the talk in general when he asked, I don't understand what the whole point of ethics, of Jewish medical ethics is in particular. We have something called halacha. Halacha doesn't change, science changes. And I think I'm going to start with that. Although I see a glass of water, which I may also take. I'm going to start with that as a starting off point to talk about why I think Jewish medical ethics would be relevant for doctors. It's not only doctors. I'm sure there are other people whom Jewish medical ethics would be relevant to. I'm not a doctor, a medical doctor, and it's relevant to me, especially since it's part of my job. First, let me define my terms. So, it's very difficult in contemporary society to look at the relationship between law and ethics, or between halacha and medical, or halacha and Jewish ethics in particular, because today we look at ethics the same way we look at law. We look at ethics as a rule-based system, whether it's treat everyone like an ends and not as a means, or do whatever's best, or in medical ethics you have the cycle of principalism, which is basically pick four values and maximize that to the best you can given your facts and the values that you have. Ethics was never meant to be like that, and the reason why we have ethics is as not something that's above law, but it's something that complements law. while law looks at rules and how one should act, and there is a coherent system, it looks at, when you think about law, when you think about a particular act, you're looking at what I should do at the moment. Ethics looks at what a legal system or what a normative system contains, which are both going to be natural and social facts, but they'll also be the values embedded in those facts, to what can I learn from acting within the law, or acting according to the law, or learning about the law, to understand what values I can embody, more importantly, what type of person I can become. So when you look at halakha, you're going to see, what can I do? What can I do in this case? Right? When you hear about Jewish medical, when you hear about Jewish ethics, you used to hear about something called midos, right? Or virtues, or character, or about looking at halakha changes who you are. So when I'm going to talk about Jewish medical ethics, I'm going to talk about not only specific shilas in certain cases of what you do, but what we can learn about in terms of what is not only our priorities, but how do we prioritize those priorities. Does that make sense? Okay. So Jewish medical ethics in this situation is actually, there's three different types. I'm going to go through the three different types, and then I'll give two examples in the medical ethics sphere. Two of those types are important because we live in a multicultural environment. We don't live alone. Therefore, we're always going to get pushback, or we're always going to be in discussion with the society that we're part of, whether we like it or not. The other one is a little bit more internal, which I'll get to. The first one I'll call pragmatic, the second one I'll call patriotic, the third one I'll call personal. Both the pragmatic and the patriotic look at Jewish ethics and Jewish medical ethics as giving reasons for the commandments. Right? It basically tries to say, oh, we're supposed to do this, let me tell you why. Now, of course, as we talked about Hukim, sometimes you just don't know why, but in general, they have a specific or particular type of agenda because we live in a multicultural environment. Because they have a certain type of agenda, the reasoning that you're going to use is going to be a reasoning from the outside onto the halakhic system. Meaning you're using it to persuade, not yourself, but persuade others. The personal is a little bit more internal. It's actually reasoning from the commandments. Meaning we see what the halakha is. We know, because we understand the halakhic system, what those values are. And using those halakhas kind of like data, we can understand what to learn out of it. So now let me explain. The pragmatic is basically a way to effectively persuade society to allow for religious freedom in a peaceful way. Gives an explanation for why observance of halakha should be permitted in a multicultural society. However, what that does is halakha now becomes normalized. And when I say normalized, what I mean is halakha only now fits the mold that society will allow it. And you can see this both in terms of the Beis Din doesn't deal with criminal law. More importantly, the Beis Din of America especially is a practical example, as a court of arbitration, can only give verdicts that are within the, quote, dalet amos of American civil law. Because if it's not within the dalet amos of American civil law, then those cases would be vacated by the courts. Meaning it's not that they're not being halachic, but within the realm of Shara, they are picking the framework to match what they can do in practice. Right? But it's also very important from a society perspective, because you want to make sure that you're allowed to do what you're allowed to do. Right? So, I'll give this example, but just an example off the head. If you have a situation, let's say in California, where people are advocating against circumcision because they see that it's cruelty to children, you're not going to say, no, for our children it's not cruelty. You're talking past them. So it's not going to be a convincing argument. Right? So you want to find a pragmatic way to be in dialogue so that the law doesn't change against your favor. Right? So you have this case. Also, I want to thank Dr. Friedman for the example. Of the Par Aduma. And there's a story in the Midrash where a certain person asks, a non-Jewish person asks, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, I don't understand this Par Aduma. It doesn't make any sense. Someone gets
Tahar, someone gets Tameh, there's light, there's death. This doesn't make sense to me. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, I don't understand you. Have you ever seen a person who is possessed by demons or by madness? He's like, yeah, of course. You see my family. He didn't say that. That was a joke. He goes, okay, fine. So you know what I'm talking about. What do you do when you see someone who's possessed by demons? He's like, oh, well, we bring roots, we make smoke, we sprinkle water, and we try to exorcise those demons. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, well, then I don't understand why you're asking me any questions. Clearly, you have a methodology to deal with something that, while may not make sense to the outside, makes sense to the respect that you think it's normal and you do this. And the person says, you know what, you're right. Thank you very much. Goes on his way. Now, his students say, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, I don't understand it. You may tell them that reason, but what do you tell us? Now, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, in this case, says, first off, I'm not giving you reasons. It's a hoax. Thank you, Dr. Friedman, for reminding us of that. God makes these rules. But the point of the story is not what he tells the Talmidim. It's why he feels the need to tell the non-Jewish person this story. The reason is because sometimes when you live in an environment where it's not completely under your control, you have to find examples outside of your tradition in order to allow for your tradition to be practiced. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai wasn't denigrating, God forbid. He wasn't misinterpreting. He was giving an explanation that people could hear in order to get what he wants. Does that make sense? It's pragmatic. Clearly, that's the most shelo lishma version of Jewish medical ethics. Not the one that I would say is we should have as a Jewish medical ethics conference that's international. But nonetheless, it's out there, and when we look at Jewish medical ethics arguments, whether in America or Israel or anywhere else, it talks to not just Jews but to a greater environment. You have to understand what is the modus operandi of the author. So the second example is patriotic. Now, when I say patriotic, I don't necessarily mean like you're a patriot. What I mean is that you want to work effectively to enter the public conversation because you think that Jewish values have value. And if they have value for Jews, then they should have value for everybody. I mean, that makes sense. The problem with this is that halacha, or Torah in general, has two different legal systems, one for Jews, and the Sheva Mitzvos B'nai Noach for non-Jews. So when you start looking at Jewish values from a greater public perspective, some of the arguments that may work for you are not going to work given the Noachite commandments, right? And some of the things that you would say are okay, you're now not going to say is okay because it doesn't fit the greater framework. Now, I'll give two examples here. The first example, just because we were talking about Peru Revu, is if a brother and a sister both convert. Right? So people who convert, they have no yichus to their family anymore. They're like reborn children. So therefore, according to the Torah, they can marry each other. However, and by the way, when the Torah looks at yichus, you have to understand that there is a certain biological aspect to yichus, but there's also a very certain social and political aspect to yichus, and that's where it's really coming through. But Derabbanan, the rabbis say, no. This is not a good idea because you don't want these converts to say, whoa, here we come from a tradition that understands the wrongness of incest, and here we're going to a Jewish tradition which allows it. Well, it doesn't allow it, but in this situation there's a very political nuance or a halachic nuance because of yichus that might allow, so the rabbis understand that that's not something that can be promoted. So they say, in this situation, brothers and sisters don't. But I'll give you a Jewish medical example that has a little bit much more, I'd say, difficulty for today. So in halacha, and this is very complicated, and I won't go into all the details, but in certain cases, a therapeutic abortion is mutter, right? Now, we understand that because we know what our value system is. And we might want to promote that in a greater society. But we have difficulties when we look at what the halacha says with regards to abortion in Sheva Mitzvos B'nai Noach. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin, quotes Rabbi Yishmael, it says, a Noachide who aborts a fetus has the legal status of a murderer. right? And that's quoted by the Rambam. So now, it could be interpreted, because it's a legal statement, as either it has the legal status of a murderer, but not the moral status of a murderer, or it could be interpreted as, no, it has the moral status of a murderer, the capital punishment fits the crime, and it's not just a matter of what capital punishment is in Noachai law in general. Regardless, if you're advocating something in American society or in Canadian society, do you look at Jewish values from the halachic perspective? Or do you look at Jewish values from the Noachai perspective? Because that's the majority that you're talking to. Does anyone want to answer that? I'm kidding. I'm gonna keep going. More importantly, you also have to ask, when you live in a Noachai community, what is your relationship to the greater culture? Do you have an obligation not only to follow Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach as a citizen, but to promote it, right? Is there an issue of Lifnei Iver if you're a doctor who treats a non-Jewish patient and they want to ask for something that's against Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach? If there's no Isser of Lifnei Iver, and there's potentially no Isser of Tochacha, then maybe this is a societal argument or a societal issue that we play more pragmatic than patriotic, or maybe we don't get involved at all, or maybe we look at it from a third perspective, which I get to. But regardless, when you look at Jewish medical ethics in this perspective, it's not only a matter of, well, what does the halacha say? It's also a matter of, well, what is the halacha trying to tell us about what's important in the values? And it's also trying to tell us, when you live in a society with other people, how do I interact with them in a way that not only promotes peace, but promotes my way of life in the most optimal type of way? So now here comes the third one, which is the personal perspective. The first two, does anyone have any questions on that so far? We'll take questions at the end? Okay. So the personal goes, it's actually already done in many ways, just maybe explained differently. It's really the difference between chinuch and Talmud Torah, right? So chinuch teaches you what to do, right? Now, we want to say, oh, it teaches you what to do, but what to do in terms of you tell the child to put this on and to go do this and to say this, right? So it's in practice, but it's not only in practice. You learning halacha lemaisa is a type of chinuch because you need to know what to do. Talmud Torah is not really about training you on how to act. It's teaching you how to appreciate what you do and to understand what you do in a context that is much greater than the act itself. It tries to show you how each halacha has not only practical importance, but theoretical importance in terms of what does this mean in terms of my emunah, my bitachon? What does this mean in terms of my yira? What does this mean in terms of how I interact with people? What does that actually mean in terms of who I am living with others and what Ahava means, right? So the Rambam and Shmona Brachim mentions this already, and it's even earlier, and we should bring it back now, even though it's there, but just maybe not emphasized as much. He talks about when people create habit, and he talks about this both in terms of conversion and in terms of just in general living. You want to learn what to do, obviously. But after you learn what to do, if you don't learn in terms of Talmud Torah, then what you do becomes a much more of a struggle every day, not only in terms of acting, but in terms of not having what you do be robotic. But if you learn and you love the wisdom behind the halachas, then your heart is naturally more inclined towards keeping the halachas, and you understand and greater appreciate why God gave us the halachas, right? Then not only do you have this idea of, oh, well, medical halacha, but you become a doctor who takes that professionalism and takes the Jewish medical ethics of these practices into their daily life and daily understanding of what that means for the person. So that's the personal aspect. So you have the pragmatic, the patriotic, and the personal. Now, I was going to give two examples specifically in medical ethics where Jewish medical ethics can play a particular role. And I think it's an important role if done in... I would like to say done in all three ways with varying degrees. So the first is with regards to reproductive technology. So in general, in the greater society, there's two major views about reproductive technology, which really means there's two major views about the mitzvah rabba pruravu. And I say that because I want to keep the terminology the same, even through Jewish ethics. So there's the first view that looks at personhood autonomy, that says, I can do whatever I want or whatever I think is best with regards to reproductive technology. And that doesn't only mean having children, but having the type of children that I want. Because I'm an autonomous, independent person who can make rational decisions. There's the flip side of that that says, no. When you do that, you treat your children as property. And what you really should be doing is recognizing that you're not an owner of children, but you're a guardian of children. And the manner in which you do that is not by looking at reproductive technology as a means to get what you want, but you should look at the whole idea of reproduction as a gift that whatever you get, if you get, you should be grateful for. Now, these are the two extremes of the debate. Now, Jewish medical ethics, or the Jewish worldview, doesn't fit either of those extremes, right? The Jewish view looks and says, no, first off, we could become partners with the Kadosh Baruch Hu in creation, and that means utilizing natural and scientific law and techniques and methods to create and improve upon our environment. But it also includes an aspect of whatever God gives us is for the good, and we have to appreciate that. Right. Moreover, and this is where it gets complicated, while Puravu is a mitzvah on every individual person according to certain posting, irrespective of gender, with Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, Puravu is on society as a klal, not as a prat for each individual. So how you look at the balance between gratitude and control, and I mean control in a good way, not control in a bad way, should also be relevant in the greater debate on reproductive technology with respect to, well, how much is this being seen as a mitzvah that I'm obligated to do and a right that I'm empowered to do? Okay? In this respect, Jewish medical ethics has a huge role to play if it can be involved in a debate like that. The second one is with regards to mental illness. Now, there was a lot of debate, more than a year ago, on the categorization of mental illness. And it was looked at from two different ways, both of which are trying to find some sort of coherence in this. One was a plethora of new mental illness categorizations. The other was a push to look at mental illness strictly in terms of biology. What was it? Thomas Insel had this idea of schizophrenia, looking at, don't look at behavior. Behavior doesn't mean anything. Look at what goes on in the brain, and from the brain, then you should be able to diagnose. And there's a lot of seichel in both situations. In one, because mental illness is both a medical or a scientific issue and a social issue, you want to look at how people behave in society and see if it fits social norms or not. In another respect, you want to say that, well, when society doesn't have social norms that are as strong as a communitarian view, but really they emphasize the aspects of individuality, then the only objective way we can look at it at that point can only be through science. Right? So you see where this is coming from. So now, when you look at the halachas that are related to mental illness, both in terms of mental illness that's considered physiological and psychological, both of them have this common theme, if you will. It looks at behavior, but it looks at behavior not only in terms of does it fit social norms or not, but given that person's frame of reference, can you understand the rationality behind the person's actions? Right? So what that does is, maybe not in terms of some of the larger issues that we have, but at least in terms of trying to find criteria that doesn't create problems with individuality and identity, is not everything that a person has can be pathologized. More importantly, even if something could be pathologized, that doesn't mean that it's biological or strictly social. It could be a manner of bad habits have created a character that's very difficult to now undo, right? And you know, you actually see this when the Rambam talks about the physician, and he talks about the physician in contradistinction to Aristotle, which is a really amazing thing. Not that in itself, that you hear in any Jewish conference, but in this aspect, Aristotle talks about the physician as someone who you go to avoid getting sick. But once your character and your lifestyle has created the problems that you have, it's very difficult for you to get out of, both morally and in terms of your health. Where with the Rambam, he looks at the doctor, uses the metaphors of the doctor as a similar way for someone when we look at morally is tshuva, right? It's for someone who, if they've become sick morally, then you go to someone who can teach you to become better. Same with the doctor. If you become unhealthy, you can go to the doctor to become better. From the aspects of mental illness and psychology, when it comes to those that might be about habituation, then we recognize that people are much more plastic, able to change the way they are based on what they do. It may allow for some of the controversy within the mental health profession today to be seen in a different light. So I mentioned a lot, but what I want to do is at least give context to some of the debates that go on in medical ethics in general, and look at some of the strategies that Jewish medical ethics can get involved in. The patriotic way is the one that looks at, it's not interfaith, but intercultural. How can we find a common language to speak together? The pragmatic is, I just want to be able to do what I want without interference. And the personal is, when given the freedom to do what I want, how can it make me a better person? So thank you very much.